Hello and welcome to the Dance Futures podcast. Or rather, welcome back to the Dance Futures podcast. It's been a while. This is the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. I'm your host, professional dance geek, Dr. Ruth Pethybridge, and I'm really excited to be bringing you three special episodes in which I am going to talk to current students on the new MA Dance Participation, Communities and Activism at London Contemporary Dance School. I was invited to join the team creating this course, and it has been such an inspiring and motivating and kind of galvanizing experience to work with the current cohort. And I just couldn't not share some of the conversations we've been having with a broader audience. They're too good. So this week's theme is resistance. What does it mean to resist as dance artists? And joining me to discuss this is Anno Bollander, based in Frankfurt, and Marília Coelho, based in Brazil. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation as much as I did, and keep listening to hear from the other students on this unique programme. Hello, Anno and Marília, welcome to Dance Futures. Thank you so much for making time to be with me here today on what is, at least in Europe, International Women's Day, something that we might refer to later on in the podcast. We're recording on this auspicious day. I would love to just, for you guys, to introduce yourselves. The listeners have heard a little bit in my intro. Anno, I wonder if we could come to you first.
At the moment, I'm sitting on the old chaiselong of my grandmother in my flat in Frankfurt. I'm based in Offenbach, Frankfurt, in Germany, as a performance artist, like in the broadest sense. I do transdisciplinary performances with different collectives, mainly focusing on care, tenderness, queerness, and activism. And I also do a lot of teaching and educational work. I'm doing a queer referat for a youth center, so like the role of a queer advocate in a bigger youth center in Frankfurt. And my biggest project at the moment are a mixed abled dance project called Reclaiming Dance, and a queer performance collective with whom we're doing an installation work later in the year. Thanks for letting me be here.
So much in there. This is great. We'll try and unpack a little bit of that as we go along. And Marília.
Hi, Ruth. Thank you for the invitation. I'm a dance artist. I'm from Brazil. I live in Botucatu, in the countryside of São Paulo, where we have, with other artists, a cultural space the place that I work with dance and as a solo and also with groups. I also teach, and yeah, that's my life here.
Amazing. And I have seen some images of this center where you work and the place that you live, Marília, also. And I think for listeners at home, it's nice to know this kind of contrast of your sitting at 8 a.m. in the morning in quite extreme heat in Brazil, which is very different. From where I am right now in a windy Cornish countryside. So it's amazing the power of Zoom to bring us together like this. And I'm really excited about this episode because the Dance Futures podcast has kind of was put to kind of rest for a little bit. So a bit like when you garden, you do some gardening and then you're like, I'm just going to leave it to mulch for a bit and see. But I wasn't ready to like draw a full line under it. And then meeting you guys on the cohort of the MA Dance Participation, Communities and Activism has kind of made me think about it again, because it feels like we're trying to create a different kind of future, and dance is a very big part of that. And sometimes it feels futile, sometimes it feels inspiring, but working with you guys on this has definitely been A real kind of awakening, I guess. And so Dance Futures is part of that, coming back to life to discuss these three themes that we kind of use on the course a little bit. And today we're going to talk about resistance as the theme, but also we can deviate from that theme and just hear about your practice because it sounds fascinating. And my first question to guests is often about how do you describe your practice to somebody who maybe isn't in dance, right? So, like, I can hear, I know you're talking about queerness and tenderness, and I can easily sort of translate this in my embodied understanding to a dance studio and how that might work. But I'm always curious about the kind of dinner party scenario or the social scenario where you get asked that question, like, what do you do then? And you have to respond in a way that is like, that makes sense to people who are not necessarily in the sector or have all that language available to them.
That's really not easy. I think mainly the not easy part about it is that we as artists, we do so much and so many different things, and especially in the last decades, the arts field and also especially the dance field has expanded in so many different sub genres, and everyone is working kind of everywhere. So you can't just, normally people are happy when I say I'm doing dance, and they're like, oh, you're on stage, oh, you look like that too, and then I'm like, mostly not actually. I'm normally not on stage, and then I try to like but I try to work with that image of like the stage and what can dance be, and I try to say maybe I try more to make the stage a place for other people, maybe for people who are not so often there, who cannot enter a space so easily as I am, I am capable of, and you can then translate that to like a lot of different things. You can see this as giving topics a visibility on stage. You can see this as with I said in the Reclaiming Dance project, it's an inclusive project for everyone who's interested in contemporary dance. So people with mixed abilities, but also elderly people, queer people, are invited to dance with us and to just open the space. If it's a workshop, if it's a dance class, if it's actually a performance, we already did two performances. We try to create a space and a stage to make things visible that are not visible in our society. And this is something that I try, but yeah, I don't know if that always
You know, if it's always
works out
successful.
so much.
Great. But yeah, that kind of meeting someone where they're at with their reference point, like a stage, for example, is, yeah, can be a good way in for sure. Marilia, what about you? Do you have a dinner party answer to this question?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm thinking here that for the last decade, I've been working with dance in an anti-colonialist perspective. But if I try to explain this for the people that surrounds me here, they even can't understand what contemporary dance means. It's interesting because I think for the most of people here, dance is something related to television or something far, or maybe ballet, maybe. And I've been working with experimental dance. So it's a kind of hard to explain. But I also try to bring this idea that everybody can dance, and everybody has this possibility to dance. It's something that I've been studying for my entire life.
Yeah, this is beautiful, this thing of kind of going, listen, everybody can dance, and this is a a baseline to try to bring people in, whether that's even just at the level of this conversation, right? Anna.
Yeah, I just thought about something that I sometimes do, to because people mostly say when I say what I'm doing is like, Marilia also says, I can't dance because their image of dance is something on the television or in the ballet, in the corps de ballet or something like that.
Yeah.
And to try to make them understand that I do actually believe that everyone can dance who wants to dance. Is that I say, like, look in the, like, in the theater halls, in the big contemporary dance programs, what they are doing. They're not like they're not doing ballet anymore. They're doing normal, weird movements. I mean, I danced with a huge ton of clay for half an hour. They're doing really like things that are not that you could also do. And this is like the big theater hall. So I believe that everyone could do that. And this is sometimes how I think it's made possible to understand that this broader vision of dance.
Yeah, the broader vision, like you say, is important. And Marilia's comment about people not always even having a point of reference for what contemporary dance is, then you're kind of, you're already at this starting point of how much do you kind of try and explain? And it, yeah, it's always an interesting one for me, because I feel like a lot of what I do is very niche as a dance researcher. And there is something that I really celebrate about how niche it is and how specific it is and the kinds of conversations I can have in a room of people who are also in that niche. But I'm also really passionate about how we extend this knowledge and share this knowledge. And I guess this podcast is one of those things, right? It's like, how can we open up this kind of very specific knowledge to more people? So talking about practice, this is another thing that I find that exists in this niche, right, where we talk about our practice and it feels quite normal to talk about that. One definition of practice is that it's something that you do, it's kind of like almost like a routine, it's something that you do again and again and again. And so I was wondering if you could give listeners like almost, it's almost a bit of a day in the life, like a sense of like, what is a practice, or how does your practice manifest in the repeated things that you do over time?
My days, it would be quite boring because a lot of my days is actually sitting on the laptop.
This is the reality though, right?
This is the reality. I did end up, it sounds so bad, but it's not meant in a bad way, but I did end up in normally in the position in collectives that organize, like, is not only immersed in the artistic process but is also the producer and the organizer and the networker, kind of. So a lot is just like being in conversation with lots of different people, lots of different spaces, thunders,
yeah.
Unfortunately. So maybe something about my practice that is a bit more important in an artistic or in a social sense is that I always try to create a space and this can be like a very short space, like in a dance class. It's always my question, okay, where do I stand, where can the other stand, how do I establish the space in the beginning? It can also be an actual space that I'm creating. For example, an installation is really about to form a fixed space in which people can get information and experiences, or like a party space that can be like I do organize a rave series in Frankfurt, but also birthday party at home. So it's always trying to create this experience space for people.
Nice. Yeah. So creating spaces very literally in putting together practical spaces where people can have an experience, and then also kind of metaphorically in like these collective conversations that you're having with different people to make stuff happen. Yeah, this is a really nice way of putting it. Yeah, thank you. Marilia.
Yeah, and having a space, I think I have a possibility to practice constantly. This is a big thing for me, and it's a very special thing for me because I like to research my dance practice. And I in a first moment I like to listen my body to understand what it's happening inside, but I always like to go outside and think the other layers of dance, like basic things like speed and different movements, the shapes, but also the relations between interpersonal relations and also interspecies relation. How can we yeah, because I like when my surrounding crosses me and inspires me to move. So that's the way I try to practice. And I also do some, now I'm 40 years old, so I like to do some strength movements to keep my body dancing. It's important to say this now. And I love to do some deep stretches, and I really like to move. It's really important for me and for my health, my mind, and for my everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is really important to say that, like you say, Marilia, that also at different life stages there are different things that we feel our body needs, and when we're not in regular training or like this, we're learning in this kind of online community and then coming together. But it is yeah, this thing of like how do you stay connected to your own body and movement possibilities is it's a real discipline actually to kind of keep in touch with that, I find, talking from a personal perspective as a mother of two and working and kind of going, I really need to greet my body in the day somewhere at some point. And I really like this thing you said of like having the space is really important, but also the way that your practice kind of spills out from that and also invites in other beings is really lovely. And maybe for listeners, yeah, the forest, you live close to forest, right? So this is when we're talking about surroundings, it's quite specific. Yeah, very different to some people who might be listening, living in an apartment in a city. I know. Yeah, who we might be talking to who live in an apartment in a city. Who could we be talking to? But you do have like huge roses behind you in this background. This is
Yeah, like
so.
this is also my because you were talking about International Women's Day. This is
Yeah.
my feminist corner in the room because it's like my it starts with my granny.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Maybe that's a really nice moment to start more specifically thinking about our theme, which is resistance. And I think I remember sharing with you before this definition that I enjoy that actually kind of comes from nature, I think, which is where it's like where there's maybe like some small thing that stops one force completely overwhelming another. And so it makes me think also of this expression that we have in English, which is a thorn in your side or a thorn in my side, which is like this little, somehow it's like smaller than revolution or like, you know, I don't know, even protest maybe, because it's kind of, but it's this thorn or this spirit that doesn't give up or doesn't get overwhelmed by the dominant kind of forms or the dominant ways of being. And yeah, I guess I'm wondering about, I can hear it in what both of you say. Like Marilia, you talked about anti-colonialist dance, for example. And I know bringing queerness in there, which I think is a really great example of how resistance can kind of create whole subcultures that, yeah, kind of ripple out to so much wider society. I don't even know how to form my question. I'm just like getting excited by the theme and thinking, and my mind's jumping around. But maybe a simple way to ask it initially is just like, how do you see that this shows up in your practice?
Yeah. Well, I think to live in Brazil, or I believe in the a global South country, we grew up in this resistance mood, without knowing exactly why or what is happening. But in certain point of my life, in a personal way, I was a kind of tired to resist, because it's, yeah, we start to feel tired because we have to deal every day, daily, with things that, like, invisible forces that are forcing us to do things, or to keep surviving or keep alive.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think strategically, personally, I started to change this perspective of this word resistance, but I understand that I could flow more and not let the things go, but I could insist in other perspectives. Or yeah, it's kind of resistance, but I have to say there's two forces that are against each other. In a certain moment, I was tired about that. And yeah, and I started to let them flow or mix. And what can I do using this resistance force in a more fluid way, that I could be more relaxed? Or yeah, it's just a kind of imagination about my situation here, but I think it's related with dance when I put this on my own body.
Yeah.
And for me, it's totally related in this anti-colonialist perspective, because talking about my dance, I started to understand that I wanted to dance in a way that was not so impositive. I mean, when I think in dance business, or if I need to survive with dance, I need to do a specific dance to have money to survive.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not what exactly I wanted to do. So how can I be this strategy? How can I have strategies to keep doing what I want in a way that I believe, and survive in the same time without having five or six works, different works, as Anna said, as artists, we have to do many things.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I've been researching dance in different ways of thinking, inspired by indigenous knowledge from all around the world, not only in Brazil, and being aware about colonialism and the things that are my country in this moment are dealing, like the indigenous in north in Brazil are suffering a lot from the people who extract gold from the and other minerals. I don't know the name in English. And this is financed by European companies. So
yeah,
come on. And yeah, so how can dance has to do something about this? Maybe nothing, maybe many things, because dance can bring this kind of aware of our living beings in this country, like who I am, what should I do, what can I do to fight against this kind of thing. And I think this starts inside in our bodies. I'm not sure if I'm confusing now.
No, I don't think you are. I think it's there's very just a lot. It's a big, it's these big things.
Yeah, it's
where we're like,
big thing.
How do we as artists and dancers kind of interact with these huge global issues?
Yeah, because all the globe are having problems with this, because Amazon is it's really important for the whole globe,
Yeah.
and all the climate exchanges related to that, and wow, so the things are keep going, and the deforestation are keep happening. What should we do? I don't know, but in my context, I really believe that dance can bring this kind of aware of who we are in this world, and how can, what as an individual, what can I do? And I think we can think dance in this potential way of being aware, and also in this sense of collectiveness. Like, because dance brings this power in collectivities, and we can be together. And I think to be together, these gatherings are really powerful to change a context that these people are. I can see this in my work. My space here, it's not so big. Yeah, it's big, but when I think in São Paulo and Brazil, it's not so big. But we are here together for now for 12 years, and we really can see some change in the city. So this is really interesting. And
really many things, but it's great how you zoom back into the changes that your space is potentially making, like you say. I really liked also the point you made, and I was aware that listeners couldn't see what your hands were doing, which was like really... So these two fists like bashing together against each other, because yeah, resistance kind of connotates and a moving against something, right? Doesn't it? Like not letting something kind of just go or flow or something. And so that, like you say, there's a kind of an exhaustion that can come from pushing against all the time. And we did a little physical experiment once, didn't we? Like it's very small, but like, you really push against something like a wall or something you just know isn't going to move, like how much energy you can use doing that, and then how could you shift that so that the wall is a support, for example. So I think this, for activist practice in resistance, this is a really important point, Marilia, that you make about also how you knowing when to let go also, and how resistance can take on these other forms, which kind of also I think really resonates with some of Anno's concerns around tenderness, right, that can be found in city. I always remember you introducing this concept of the tender city to me, and I was like, ah, ping, light bulb.
Yeah, I mean, I thank you, Marilia, for bringing like this like global perspective, and also this notion of being exhausted. And maybe I can, like, I'm speaking with two mothers, and you're also both, I would say, a little older than me. So maybe I can bring in the perspective, like, from, I'm in my 20s now, and I'm already also exhausted, but I'm still at this point where I'm, like, also feel a lot of anger, actually. And I remember when I first came for the first residency, I came to London, and I was in Cafe Otto, and they have this little library, and I was sitting there and reading that book of Sara Ahmed, The Feminist Killjoy. And she just poses some questions, like, have you been the person sitting in your family on your family table for Sunday dinner, and you're always that person who just can't shut up, who is posing that question, or who is saying something against this, and who is saying something against that? And I could, like, she had these questions, and I was like, yes, 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 yes. And I really like this notion of that she brings with this concept, which she really means positive. It's not a bad concept. She says it's really what, not only what we need, but what we also need is staying uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Really staying with the trouble that is now, like, I think Donna Haraway, sliding from the other side. But staying where it's not nice, or what Dana Yahalomi told us in the first residency of the MA program, this being the bacteria on a wound and sawing it out, kind of.
Yeah.
And I think I try that in my daily life, but I also try to do it in my projects. So when we come to the project with the Tender City, it's called Soft City Inscribed. We did it. It was a site-specific performance we did in Wiesbaden last year with a collective called Archiv der Zärtlichkeit. And it was to on the one hand really staying with this like kind of horrible situation of being in the city and everything is loud, everyone is exhausted. And we had a sound artist called Kate Voivod, and they were recording live the sound of the city and amplifying it really to like a huge like warming of this stressful city sounds. And in the end we shattered that down, and also so I was a dancer and we had another dancer, we just crashed completely down on the floor. And then the sound artist, they took out the little bits and pieces of the city that were really nice, like a bird twittering, is it the word? No,
yeah,
bird.
Twittering, or yeah, tweeting, yeah.
And making some kind of really wobbly sound out of it. And then we had like we came to that tender part and that more like leaning into the city. And but it only came with that being overwhelmed at first, being uncomfortable to be able to find that relation to like a comfortable relation again.
I think this is really important when thinking about resistance, and how, yeah, maybe it's also a cycle, right, of when we have the kind of rage and the energy and the kind of fight energy, and then when it tips and you know it's like, okay, rest, retreat, resource in order to be able to do that again. You know, I mean, there's loads we could talk about around burnout for activists and artists, you know, and then you touch also on the role of the artist in society and how we see that and what that is. Like, it isn't always to make us comfortable and reflect something back that is easy. For sure, resistance has a big part to play in that, you know, and I feel like I'm seeing quite a lot of inspiring examples of that at the moment, of people just trying to resist something that feels very out of their control. And for sure, artists can bring that, and also bring this, I see in both of your work, as Marilia said, this collectivity, this feeling of this sense of connection with others, that can also kind of generate the energy to resist. I think, like, sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's just like hard to find that alone, or hard to find that from within. And then when you're amongst other people and you're connected to them in an embodied way, things begin to feel more possible, or you even feel like maybe you have more power, you know, just simply that, like the power of multiple bodies together, right? It's more than a singular body.
No, I'm just remembering how I'm inspired by the indigenous people here in Brazil, because I think resistance is a very important word for them. Like, since the invasion in their territories, they are surviving, resisting many, many, many things. And I just want to say that when they meet each other, different ethnical groups, because it has a lot here, the first thing they do is dance and sing. So this is amazing, because yeah, they find this collectivity in in dance, and I think it gave him power to keep going, to keep surviving. Yeah, just this, just to share this.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a friend and colleague sent me a piece today about Iranian DJs, women DJs who are, you know, resisting all these oppressive laws to create underground party spaces, you know, and really being at the helm of that. And some of them are now starting to play internationally. And yeah, so I think in, yeah, it has this role in all in different cultures in all these different ways, right? To create these spaces, like you say, and to bring people together, but also that is a way of resisting on multiple levels. And I think the anti-colonialist decolonialization, this is so important. Marilia, you brought this to me a while ago, and I had such, again, I've had lots of interesting spin-off conversations about the terminology and you know, with decolonization as a just as an idea that we can't ever not have it. So sometimes this sounds like we're trying to undo it, and then post-colonial, it's like, well, it's not finished, like you said, you know, this is still very much going on, even in the mine situation you talk about. So it's not afterwards, and yet there is something about acknowledging a time in history and geography when some stuff happened. So it's also like trying to map this and find the right words, and it's also not a metaphor, right? There are people who really want their land, they just actually want their land back. And it's like not a metaphor for like what books we read. It's like, no, this is the real struggle. And I say that because as an academic, I'm trying to look at the books that we read and think about what, like you said, Marilia, like multiple perspectives, and making sure that that is part of how we resist dominant narratives, right? And that's something that I'm trying to bring to the MA course. It's hard because it's not as available, and you have to look and you have to dig and you have to, so yeah, it's really shows up these the dominant.
And I have to say that the most of people here don't are not aware of all of this. Of course, everybody feels the things, but yeah, here in Brazil, we have this specific situation with this lack of education. So I have to say that I have a privilege just to keep studying in my life. I'm not the majority here.
Yeah.
So I can talk about these kind of things. I'm here in this course, but the most of people don't have this opportunity. And so how can I, as an artist, can return to society with all this knowledge, and how can I share all of this to the people? And I think dance is a very important tool to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful, Marilia. Yeah, Anna, were you going to?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump on that terminology idea, because as you said in the beginning, it's International Women's Day in Europe, and for example, this is because we're in the course, we're talking a lot about intersectionalism, and there are always lines to like draw between the different like discrimination mechanisms, and so I just thought about this, like International Women's Day. For me, as a queer person, as a non-binary trans person, it's like kind of I'm being like, yeah, well, thank you. And we had this talk before that here in Germany, they are like a lot of the leftist people renamed it into Feminist Fighting Day. So you have this resisting element. So it's not just like a day, but it's a day of resistance. It's a day of fighting, as is every other day. But this day, we celebrate that we're fighting, and we celebrate that we're uncomfortable. We celebrate that we stay with the trouble and try this fluidity that Marilia talked about. And obviously that it's not called just Women's Day, but Feminist Day, that includes actually everyone who's a flinter person. So it stands for women, lesbian, into non-binary, trans and agender people in German. Every Flinter person on, and also allies. And just like a little funny point to that. I'm in Frankfurt and obviously I'm working, so this is nothing for me, but in Berlin they really did a free day out of this day. They have holiday now. All my friends in Berlin are just like drinking Prosecco and celebrating feminist fighting day, and I'm just like, yeah, we need more of this. We need,
yes.
And there's this dancing, coming together, celebrating that Marilia was talking about.
Yes, and that I know we've shared before, I know, around pleasure activism and how also finding, excuse me, but finding the joy in this resistance is a huge part, again, of how we feel resourced. But I'm also like, my mind is whirring because I'm like, what, Feminist Fighting Day just sounds so much fun. Speaking of joy, I mean, I don't want to trivialize the huge issues, but I'm also like, just imagining a day where I get to just express all of the you know, just let it all out somehow and fight fully. And also, yeah, like, let's have a national holiday. Come on. Like I said, I have some new campaigns to bring locally now. See if Cornwall can follow Berlin. No, this is great. And to bring in also the fluidity around gender and how queerness also speaks to this resisting being put in these binary positions and subjectivities, which is something I've always found really, really supportive, just even though I am cisgendered, and this, I find it a very supportive and inclusive way of thinking about who I am. This, it really helps me to change and to grow queerness as a concept and as a community. Yeah. So I'm going to ask one more question. And this is a podcast called Dance Futures. And as I said, sometimes when we look to the future, it can feel, we can feel despair, we can feel hope, we can feel energized, we can feel exhausted. But in my concept for this podcast, I had this idea of, like, what would the future look like if dance was like not the thing we had to explain at a dinner party, but was kind of just somehow more a taken for granted thing in everyday life? Like, what would that look like? And this was my fantasy of a dance future, somehow that, like, at bus stops, it was normal to just have music on and people kind of having a dance together before they got on the bus, or in classrooms, that you had a 2 o'clock dance break for children every day. So there were these kinds of, these dreams that I had. And I wonder whether it can be as silly as that, or it could be more profound, that you're like, I just want more spaces that are inclusive for people to dance in. This is also great. But any little seed of anything that you would like to see in a dance future, what does that look like? We can have a pregnant pause while you give birth to an idea.
A pregnant pause, that's a good term.
Yeah, sorry, that's a very English expression.
I dream in a day. It's a kind of a fiction.
Yeah, great. I love those.
But I dream that in the future, not so far, we could have a global dance day where everybody could go to the streets without thinking to pay the bills or to survive, or where everybody has this equality in socials, living beings, and everybody have this day that everybody in the world could dance on the streets for one day.
I am so signed up for that vision, Marilia. 100%. Let's make it happen. I love it.
Please.
Amazing. I've got such a beautiful vision in my mind's eye. Thank you. Yeah, awesome. I know.
Yeah, I think I'd love a dance future in which nobody is like in dance in dancing context, like when somebody dances on a bus stop or in the dance class that or in a rave location where nobody's asked or being looked at weirdly, like, why did you dance like that? Why do you, as a male representing person, are not the leading role of the ballroom dance? Why are you here in that, I don't know, queer context, and you look very straight? Like, that nobody has to explain themselves. And also that people who, I don't know, a friend of mine who's who uses crutches, he's always told, oh, it's so nice that you're on a party. And she's just like, I don't want to hear that. Don't tell me that. I don't need, like, I'm partying as all of you are. Don't, but this doesn't need a comment. Nothing needs a comment or a question anymore. That it's just natural. If a person wants to dance this dance, then this is beautiful.
Yes. Oh, there's so much in that as well around, yeah, visibility, and that you began with, right, about who we're used to seeing doing certain activities and not. And yeah, beautiful, an inclusive dance floor for everybody, and global dancing on the streets.
All of this
thank you so much, both of you, for your time today. I am officially renaming this day Feminist Fighting Day. It's going to catch on in the UK as well, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Marilia and Anno, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Anno. Thank you, Ruth.
Hello, welcome to the last segment of the podcast in which I get my geek on. So this is an opportunity for me to kind of share some of the academic research that exists in the realm of dance scholarship with a wider audience, and to go a little bit deeper into one of the themes presented by a conversation. Now, as this was a thematic kind of episode anyway, this was easy to think about what resistance means. And one of the things I really wanted to pick up on from the conversation is, I guess, what Marilia indicated, which is that resistance looks very different for different people depending on circumstances and also cultural contexts and privilege and positionality. So I think this is really important to keep this in mind, particularly at the moment, at this time when it feels like even the way that we resist and the kind of public nature of that is being scrutinized and judged. And yeah, it can be tough out there with so thinking about where we are positioned, if you like, when we're resisting, or how our position might influence the forms that our resistance takes or how we view it, feels significant in terms of, yeah, just generating compassion and recognizing the multiplicity of ways there are to resist, I guess. So before I dive into this article that I found, I just wanted to refer to Bell Hooks again, who is a constant source of inspiration for me. And I've spoken about this writing before, choosing the margin as a space of radical openness, in which she talks about movement, that in moving we confront the reality of choice and location. So really this thing of how we position ourselves in relation to certain ideologies, like that of the colonizer, for example, and making our ways of seeing and theorizing a kind of revolutionary effort. So yeah, Bell Hooks, thank you again for making this stuff feel meaningful. So I guess that's important in the context of this article I found, readily available on Google Scholar, I believe, which is by Gonche Tasmini, and it's called West Toxication and Resistance: The Politics of Dance in Iran, hashtag dancing is not a crime. And this hashtag is referring to a particular case that in May 2018, a 17-year-old dancer, Mehdi Hajabri, was arrested for showcasing videos of herself dancing in her bedroom on Instagram. She was dancing alone. She'd posted around 300 videos, and they were all to kind of Western pop music. I guess the reason I found this article so fascinating, and in relation to this idea of positionality that I've mentioned, is because Tasmini quotes Heather Rastorak saying how dance has become a barometer with which to measure modernity, freedom and humanity. And I definitely feel like I would look at a case like this and see that her being policed for her dancing is entirely a kind of representation of the oppressive nature of the regime in Iran. And that is true to some degree, but that's also very much coming from my own westernized viewpoint, I guess. And I found this article super fascinating because it was, because it's kind of helping me to see my own assumptions that are present in the way that I might view a case like that. And obviously I learned a new word as well, West toxication, which I've never heard before, which is about the kind of Western cultural norms and values being seen as sort of toxic libertarian, but not in a good way. That was not very articulate. But West toxication, so have a look at that. And Tasmini interprets this case through this in order to kind of demonstrate it as a form of state-centric cultural resistance. And this, fascinating analysis of this very particular case of somebody dancing on Instagram. And there have been similar cases as well where women dancing in public in Iran have been forced to make very public apologies. But dancing in Iran actually isn't a crime in post-revolutionary Iran, but certain forms of dance, i.e. the more westernized forms of dance, precipitate this kind of response from the authorities. So it's the kind of Western cultural standards that are embodied in these young women's bodies that are those that create these associations of immorality, for example. So the controversy, if you like, and the discussions of this all centre around a young woman's body. And I guess that's one of the things that I find kind of so fascinating. And it's not, because the point that Tasmini makes is that folk dance and more communal Iranian dances would not be perceived in this way. So it's the solo female dancer. However, she's talking about that how the view that this is a kind of opinion of immorality, there's also so I am creating a very rambling geek out because I'm digesting this complicated argument as I share it with you. And Tasmini uses Jane Desmond's conception of dance as being kind of meaning in motion, which I really, really like this idea. And I guess the central argument that Tasmini is making is that dancing itself is not a crime in Iran, but that the way that this dancing was produced and shared, the very nature of the movements, the way that the Hajabri was dressed, all of these things were a kind of framed by this Orientalist West toxication discourse, this dialect between the East and the West, so that in order to be resisting these values, the state came down really hard on Hajabri. And so these kinds of battles, if you like, are played out through the body of this young woman who was dancing in her bedroom. I mean, this in itself is just such a fascinating phenomena for a dance geek anyway. So dance can signal, enact and rework social categories of identity. This is Desmond's proposition of meaning in motion. And in the way that she chose to dance, this teen was kind of reinforcing Western values. So the state had to resist these values, or was seen as feeling like it had to resist these values. So how do we see, even just seeing resistance as something that is a positive force, when actually it can also maybe be something repressive, is interesting, right? But my main point is that the way that we resist is, multifaceted, informed by cultural context, and definitely worth doing for the causes that make you feel angry enough to get up out of your chair and move position, move towards somebody else. Keep moving.